Broadcasting from the campus of Salisbury University, this is WSDL Ocean City, NPR News Talk 90.7, putting Delmarva first. It's time for Delmarva Today with your host, Don Rush.
This week saw another historic first. Barack Obama, the first African-American to win the presidency, has also won re-election, with 332 electoral votes to his Republican challenger, Mitt Romney's 206. The president also picked up 50% of the popular vote, Romney's 48%, but it is still a divided country.
I'm happy with the election results. I'm a big Democrat, and I come from a military family, and I like how Obama's done for them and for the vets. And I really support everything that he's done, and I like how he's tried to turn around every president and inherits whatever the last president gave them. So, yeah, he's having a negative time right now, but I'm sure it's going to turn around.
I'm not excited how the election turned out. I was hoping Romney would win.
I have my opinions on Obama and being president again because I don't feel like he got too much done in the first 4 years. But instead of complaining about it, I'm just going to hope and pray that he changes what he's doing and it betters our country instead of keeping it going downhill.
I'm happy with the results of the election just because I didn't want Romney to win. I didn't agree with a lot of his political views.
I'm not happy at all. I'm not happy. Obviously, everything he's done in the past 4 years, I mean, we're screwed, basically, my opinion.
I see what the presidents and the candidates had to offer to the world, and I'm just happy that Obama got another term for it.
I was a little disappointed in the election results. I had voted for Governor Romney, but President Obama is now my president. And like John Wayne said, I didn't vote for the man, but I wish him the best.
Well, also on Capitol Hill, Congress remained divided. Democrats still control the Senate with, I believe, about 53 seats compared to the GOP's 45. There are also two independents. Also, the House remains in Republican hands as well. To assess the impact of this election, its significance, we will be talking with Congressman Andy Harris. He is now the lone Republican, actually, in the Maryland congressional delegation. Also, later we'll talk to Maryland Delegate Anasol Gutierrez on the passage of the DREAM Act. And in studio, our residence analyst, Michael Laughlin. He's a political science professor at Salisbury University. He joins us. Also, a look at the passage of same-sex marriage measure. We also have Diane Wagner with Salisbury University, as well as Wes Davis, a former Methodist minister, as well as being with Salisbury University. And so, first of all, I want to go to Congressman Andy Harris, and welcome to the program. And first of all, Congressman, we're about two or three days now out from the election. We're beginning to see some of the results, both in Congress, but also, obviously, in the White House. What's your own assessment as to where we are politically? Obviously, you supported Mitt Romney. What's your feeling right now at the end of the week?
Well, I think it's good to be with you. I think that we're exactly where we were a week ago. Congress, it looks exactly the same as it did before, more or less. I mean, slight differences. We have the same president. We're in the same place we were when we left town for the elections in August.
So why is it, as you look at this this particular the presidential election, why do you think President Obama won and Mitt Romney lost?
Well, you know, it was obviously a very close election, and the president turned out his voters in very high numbers, and that's the way politics works. We know that in very close elections, it all depends on who turns out their voters, and obviously, especially in the swing states, Mr. Obama turned out his voters.
What about the issues? I mean, there's a lot of a sense now that the GOP certainly lost. I think it was the Hispanic vote. I think President Obama got over 70% of that. Obviously, he got the something like 90% plus. And the African-American vote picked up a lot of young folks as well. And when people were looking at the results, they were looking at a party and where you had about 70%, 72% of the vote was white. And the Republican Party seemed to be confined to fighting for that part. Do you think there needs to be some change, shift now in how the Republican approaches these emerging new demographics?
Well, certainly there will be. I was a little bit surprised that especially with the Hispanic vote, the president had the first 2 years of his administration to do whatever he wanted with majorities in both the House and the Senate, filibuster-proof Senate, and didn't do anything on immigration. And I think we're going to have to do something about immigration. We certainly haven't solved the problem, and we will deal with it. I hope the president shows some leadership. I hope we do some common sense thing. And I think that may help us with the Republicans gaining some of the Hispanic vote, which is a natural vote for Republicans. It's a group that should approve of free market, entrepreneurial, hardworking rewards for hard work. And, you know, it could be a natural fit.
Well, let me ask you this. Do you think there then has to be some kind of shift then in your party's position with regards to immigration? Because that seems to be set the tone for how the Republican Party is received and seems oftentimes to overwhelm some of the cultural issues that the Republicans may very well have been able to make in gains, particularly, say, for instance, on the issue of abortion. Do you think that you maybe need to reassess how your party is approaching immigration, and what changes, if anything, do you think you might favor in getting immigration reform passed?
Well, I personally think that we shouldn't allow citizenship for people who are here illegally, but I think we have to develop a mechanism where people can stay here on a maybe even a new class of visa that just doesn't progress to citizenship. That we admit that we're never going to return 12 million people or however many people are here illegally to their home countries, but that on the other hand, we're not going to reward people for illegal behavior with citizenship. And so I think there are compromises that can occur, common sense compromises, and that's where I'd like to see the issue go.
I want to turn to the fiscal cliff that everybody's now talking about. I guess that the president will be actually making a statement today about where we go from here in terms of cutting a deal. Earlier in the week, I noticed House Speaker Boehner talked about reaching a compromise, but he seemed to rule out any tax increase. But on the other hand, he talked about revenue increases in terms of closing loopholes. It sounds like, and correct me if I'm wrong, it sounds like Speaker Boehner's really kind of back to where we were before, that there isn't any real progress in terms of whether or not there's going to be any compromise in terms of a tax increase, say, on the upper income. Where are you on this? I mean, you that hard fast to say no tax increase whatsoever, whether even for the upper income? I mean, is that the dividing line, do you think, for your party?
I will tell you that, you know, again, the compromise has to come on both sides. I mean, the American people did reelect a majority in the Republican House, and they had a chance, just as they did in 2010, to change parties in the House. They chose not to. So I believe that they don't want higher tax rates. Can we increase revenue? Sure we can. We can look at some of the loopholes that exist, some of the deductions that exist for high earners. But increasing tax rates, is just not on the table in the House. We think we have a mandate from the American public not to increase tax rates.
So in your vision, any deal to deal with the fiscal cliff cannot include, and you read this as your party's position in the House, cannot include, say, going back to say the Clinton era tax increases, say for the wealthy, any change in the tax rates, the Bush era tax rates, those are just completely off the table for you.
Increase in tax rates are off the table in the House, and again, the American people had the chance to do like they did in 2010, change control of the House. They decided not to. None of us ran away from our positions of not increasing tax rates. Can we increase revenue? Sure we can. Let's get this economy going. Taxes will flow into the Treasury, but you can't do it by increasing tax rates. American people figured this out. If once you start increasing tax rates on the wealthy, it doesn't stop there. It goes, you will increase tax rates on everyone sooner or later. And that's just the way Washington works. It's the way Annapolis worked. It's the way, you know, big governments work. So we have to be much more clever in how we raise revenues, and it has to be through ways that encourage growth of the economy, and perhaps by starting to eliminate some of the loopholes that high-income earners use to shield their income, even from the lower tax rate.
Are you optimistic that a deal can be struck?
Look, you're asking the wrong person. You have to ask the president. I mean, you know,
There's two parties to this. I mean, not only the Republican Party, but also the president as well. And I guess what I'm asking is given the election results, however you read them, do you think that the Republicans can get together with the president and the other Democrats in Congress to come up with a deal?
The president would have to change his position. I don't believe the president's going to change his position on this.
So it's, you see that perhaps it's going to be deadlocked, and we could very well see go off the fiscal cliff then.
I hope the president doesn't let it go there.
Okay, we've been talking with Congressman Andy Harris. He is now the lone Republican in the Maryland congressional delegation. Roscoe Bartlett lost his election all through some gerrymandering process. And, Congressman, we appreciate you taking the time to speak with us.
Thank you very, very much. Have a wonderful weekend.
You too. I want to turn to Michael Laughlin. He's a political science professor at Salisbury University. Well, first of all, what is your own impression of what you heard? Because Harris is basically saying, at least, and it seems to be saying, in effect, particularly for the fiscal issue, those tax increases are simply just not on the table for him.
Well, I think what's fascinating here is he helps reveal, I think, the tension that's going to be within the Republican Party at this point in time between those who read the outcome as simply a strategic and tactical failure. Mr. Harris said he turned out his voters. Obama turned out his voters. We didn't successfully turn out our voters. And those who say this really reflects a really demographic shift in what is happening with the electorate, and that if the Republican Party is to remain competitive into the future, it is going to have to recalibrate, not simply strategy and tactics, but actually begin to shift on some very important issues. And what's further interesting was when Mr. Harris then really made a divide between the immigration question and the fiscal question. On the immigration question, what I heard was really a sense of beginning to shift and say, well, perhaps the Republican Party is really going to have to move towards some kind of immigration reform. I mean, and some of the leadership within the Republican Party have been talking vocally about a pathway to citizenship for undocumented workers. Now, Mr. Harris was more to the right of that. But even in his comments, there was, we need to revisit this. Well, why revisit this at this point in time? Because the Hispanic vote has become larger, and it's going to be larger in the next congressional elections, and of course in the next presidential election. On the fiscal question, what was interesting there was, I think for members of the Republican caucus, they may in fact continue to resist the position on tax increases. But the electorate, I mean, I think that you have to read this outcome of Obama's victory as support for increase in taxes for the upper income. I mean, if there were any issues that were actually talked about during the campaign, this was one of them, that Obama said, we got to make the rich pay a little more, right? And Romney said, no, we're going to not have anybody pay any increase in taxes. Obama wins, Romney loses. Obama has the upper hand, I think, on this negotiation right now.
And I want to turn to, by the way, to take a look at another significant development within Maryland. And, of course, that was approval of the DREAM Act that would allow actually in-state tuition for undocumented immigrants. There are some requirements attached, obviously, in terms of being here, going to Maryland schools, paying state taxes. And we are joined on the line with Delegate Ana Sol Gutierrez. She is a delegate for Maryland, and also obviously has been a very strong supporter of the DREAM Act. Welcome to the program. And first of all, I understand this is like a major event too, because voters actually came out in fairly large numbers to approve this measure. First of all, in terms of your own reaction, when you heard that this thing really passed and actually passed by such a large margin, over 50%, what was your own personal reaction first? Delegate, are you there? We may have lost her. Okay, we lost her, so we will we'll move ahead here. Well, you know, one of the things about the immigration issue is the fact that as you're talking about the shift that we're seeing, for instance, in voters here, you saw a major shift that occurred in terms of this idea that maybe there should be some break for undocumented immigrants. And there was a fairly significant percentage. What do you make of that, Michael?
I think quite clearly, again, when you look at the Obama vote, 71%, 72% of the Hispanic vote went for Obama. I think that anyone with any common sense can see that that is an outright rejection of the position that Romney had taken during not only the primaries but also in the general election, and that to emphasize once again, to underscore that any reading of what is going to be happening into the future is that the Hispanic vote is going to increase as in importance, and hence the challenge to both parties, but in particular the Republican Party, to find a way. I mean, they have to change their position. Self-deportation is not a message that's going to sell well to the Hispanic vote. It's simply an unsalable message. Hence, there has to be a shift towards immigration reform policy.
I mean, as a matter of fact, I mean Hispanics actually provided margins for Obama in both Colorado, Florida, and Nevada, which are obviously key swing states. But I guess the question I have for if you're a Republican on the immigration issue is, can you sell it to your constituency? That is to say, we saw a number of candidates, for instance, who are established Republican candidates, who ultimately didn't make it because there was this sort of Tea Party element that said, no, we want to go with, say, Aiken or some of these others. It seems to me that they got a constituency problem here. It'll be very hard to shift, even for, say, Congressman Harris's inching towards maybe not citizenship, but somewhere in between.
It's a conundrum. I mean, I think it really is a dilemma for the internal politics of the Republican Party. But if they do not cut that Gordian knot, right, if they don't cut through, they will become a regional party. They cannot retain a national competitive position without moving on this immigration issue.
I want to now turn to the other key historic, actually, vote, both here in Maryland, Maine, as well as Washington State, in which gay marriage was legalized by a vote, not just simply through the courts, not just simply the legislature, but fairly significantly. For instance, in Washington State, it was 52-48. Maine, 54-46. Maryland was actually the closest with, at least last numbers I saw, was 51-49. In studio, we have Diane Wagner. She's with Salisbury University, as well as Wes Davis. He's a former Methodist minister, as well as also with Salisbury University. And Diane, first of all, I want to turn to you. When you heard that this state had finally legalized same-sex marriage, and obviously some of the other states had been, what was your own personal reaction as you saw that happen?
Well, my reaction was a bit of disbelief. I was one of the people who was not very optimistic going into the election because of, you know, there were 38 states that have passed anti-marriage equality measures. So I thought, well, to see the trend turn around would really be something. And the results started coming in. And in Maine, for example, the vote this year overturned an anti-marriage equality referendum in 2009. So that was really historic. The votes came in, and I thought, as I listened to commentary about the changing electorate, that for the younger, more diverse electorate with broader experiences, discrimination and inequality simply are not selling points in the ballot box. Additionally, you know, the research shows that 60% of voters have a close friend or family member who is openly gay. And so despite the religious rhetoric about who should be married, I really think that at the end of the day, when it's just an individual standing in the voting booth, that it comes down to them and their children and their siblings and their family members. And it's really not about the doctrine. Now, the doctrine, you know, there was really a religious argument versus a civil argument. The law that passed in Maryland is a civil measure, has nothing to do with religion, and in fact allows churches to continue to exclude same-sex families. Churches are totally protected from being forced into carrying out any kind of marriages. I think that one of the really unfortunate parts of that whole argument is that accepting religious communities like the Unitarian Universalists, like MCC, Metropolitan Community Churches, like the Quakers, like many of the Episcopal churches, that those communities who are very welcoming to same-sex families may have inadvertently been painted with this sort of pall of intolerance. And I think that's really the most unfortunate thing that comes out of it, is the stereotype that faith communities are not loving and accepting of people.
I want to ask you, by the way, about how quickly all of this has happened. Because I remember I was actually in Washington in 1993, and I actually covered the gays in the military debates in which the Don't Ask, Don't Tell was developed. Now, you could tell that there was some shifting already going on. But just within the last 10 years, you had this dramatic shift. I mean, just 10 years ago, we had the majority of Americans who were opposed to gay marriage. By 2004, President Bush, his campaign utilized some of these, constitutional amendments to ban same-sex marriage as a way to turn out their vote. That was only like 8 years ago. Mm-hmm. And now suddenly, here we are, not only do we have gays and military lifted, right, but also we now have a movement that looks like it's now picking up steam, certainly in terms of states approving same-sex marriage, as well as just the American public. Are you surprised how quickly this has changed, but even just over the last 10 years?
Well, I think if we go back 45 years and we look at the time period between the Civil Rights Act and Loving v. Virginia in 67, which overturned Virginia's ban on interracial marriages, there's a similar thing happening there. And once you tip that constitutional domino, making the case for inequality and making the case for unequal protection of citizens becomes very difficult. And you know, we've seen federal courts again and again strike down provisions of the Defense of Marriage Act. Defense of Marriage Act is in front of the Supreme Court this session. And so I'm not surprised how quickly it's happening. I think I'm a little surprised at how slowly it began.
Mm. I want to turn, by the way, to Wes Davis. He's a former Methodist minister and also with Salisbury University. And what do you make of this shift that seems to be going? I mean, there's some people have suggested that this may be beginning the end of some of the culture wars, particularly on the religious side. How do you assess the church and the churches and how they're dealing with this on the religious side? Because there are obviously the conservative churches, still a lot of them, who say, mm-hmm. no, we oppose this. What's your sense about where that is?
Well, I served as a pastor for 13 years in the United Methodist Church. And it strikes me that even within that denomination, which is the one I observed most closely, you had a dialogue, an argument, a debate, a fight, very similar to what was going on in the culture generally. And I was mentioning to Diane earlier that that it's striking that if you look at the map of that denomination, it looks a lot like the map of the country, in terms of region and demographics and so forth, those who are going to be more accepting of in their case, full participation of gays in the church. It's apart from the civil issues that because you have in that denomination still a situation where a person who is openly gay cannot be ordained to ministry. You have a situation where the clergy are forbidden from performing same-sex marriages, even though it's now legal in the state. Within their own denomination, but those things are changing, and I see the change happening in very much in the way it's happening in the culture, and a lot of that is attitudes change because, again, as was said, it's a human issue. It's real people with faces. There's a lot of people who are ideologues who theologically, you've got political cultural ideologues, but then you have theological ideologues who is just like they have a view of divine revelation and scripture and so forth that is just black and white, hard and fast. You don't can't change or compromise it without imperiling your soul, literally. And yet you have an awful lot more people who don't come from that standpoint, who are people of serious faith, very involved in their faith community, and they have family members, they have neighbors, they have coworkers, people who are openly gay, and they just know them. People talk about being pro-family. I mean, if you got a family member who's gay and you're pro-family, you say you love them, and as you know them, you realize that the slander and the stigmatization are not true. Because there's a lot of that that goes on in religious circles. The idea that people are stigmatized, that there's something wrong with you. It's either sinful or sick or both. So, I guess what I would say is I do see a trend in this direction, and I was surprised at how quickly it's happened. But a lot of it is, and I think the heroes, if there's any heroes in helping gain greater acceptance, it's the many, many people, one by one, who've decided to come out. I don't think people appreciate always how huge that is, because when it becomes not an abstract issue, it becomes about a person that you know and love and care about and admire in many cases. It totally changes the difference. So I think as that happens more, we will see the change in the churches and in society.
Well, because one of the things that struck me particularly about Maryland is, for instance, I guess Marylanders for Marriage Equality, They spent about $4.5 million, which is about 2.5 times what opponents spent, at least as far as we know. The Mormon Church, unlike California, did not weigh in on these. They did not really become deeply involved. And it almost seems as if some of the churches, and the Catholic Church, again, didn't really get deeply involved either. Is this they recognize that this is maybe a spent issue, that they just couldn't gear themselves up as they were like 4 years ago?
Well, you know, I think that the arguments, I think that's very much what's happening, because the arguments against gay marriage are arguments, as Wes said, that revolve around love, family, commitment, and community. Look, I got an email yesterday announcing the engagement of some friends of mine who have been together for 31 and a half years. Love, family, commitment, community, check on all four counts. And so the argument has a hard time holding up when you move away from, I think, the ideologues that Wes referred to. And ultimately, what do we care about? We care about our families. We care about our friends. We care about protecting those people. And fairness is a fundamental value. In some ways, question six was the simplest question on the ballot. Do we want to be fair to people? That's what it was about.
Wes?
I'm just going to add, in talking about, and again, speaking of ideologues and so forth, and how people approach things, for instance, if you're a part of a Christian faith community and you believe, you know, you're a decent person, you love people, but you say, well, you know, the Bible says such and such, you know, therefore it must be true. I think you're also seeing with younger people, especially with access to more information, people able to educate themselves in ways that help them to take what I would call a more sophisticated approach to sacred writings, scripture, and you know, and not as much a literalist or fundamentalist interpretation of those, but people, I think, are chipping away at that argument as well as realizing that it's not as quite as cut and dried as they had been taught before. So that's part of the change that's happening, I believe.
It would turn back to Professor O'Loughlin, because one of the things I found interesting was it was, I guess, Albert Mohler. He heads the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary, and his assessment of what had happened in the election, both with the president as well as these very social issues, is, quote, we are witnessing a fundamental moral realignment of the country, end quote. Now, one of the other interesting things is that Obama actually did better with the evangelicals this time, 30%, as opposed to last time, which was 27%. And despite the opposition, for instance, of the bishops to Obamacare and the whole religious issue about birth control, Obama still won narrowly the Catholic vote as well. What do you think that says about where we are in terms of the culture wars that I referenced a moment ago?
I'm sympathetic, I think, to the view that these particular wedge issues may have been spent in terms of their political power to work in favor of the more conservative Republican Party candidates. And I'm reminded of former gay congressman Barney Frank from Massachusetts, who once, in talking about these kinds of issues, said that, well, there's a lot of fear that's involved here, and that what people fear is that if we proceed with giving gays new rights, that somehow terrible things are going to happen to our families, to marriage, and so on. And he said, but when we make these steps towards equality, we find that nothing happens. Nothing bad happens to traditional marriage. Right? That traditional marriage, people who want to continue with straight marriage, they can continue to do this. This movement towards marriage equality does nothing to harm other people's views about how they wish to proceed with their own personal lives. In fact, it expands it. I mean, so that I think that as this movement goes forward and nothing bad happens to the people who fear, that these issues will then be marginalized and perhaps go away. Now, to be sure, the ideologues will continue to hang on to it, but they're hanging on to a myth and not the empirical, real experience of people in the world. And so hence, I think that we may be at a tipping point in this election, that going forward, these issues may in fact recede in importance.
As a matter of fact, I know that there are a number of openly gay folks who have been elected to Congress. I think the latest, was Senator, out of Wisconsin. I think
yes,
it was Tammy Baldwin.
Amazing.
Which, you know, against Tommy Thompson. A lot of factors involved in that, but that didn't.
That's a wonderful example of where, in effect, I mean, you would think that Tommy Thompson was a popular governor. And a powerful politician and popular, right? And yet he loses to a gay woman, which says in Wisconsin that people that was not a critical matter for them. They were talking about economic issues and these other political issues. Being gay was largely irrelevant to the calculus there.
I think what is interesting is at least what I saw the coverage. It didn't even – the issue of sexual orientation didn't even really become an issue. It was all about tax and the rest of it. Yeah. Well, we have to wrap this up. We, of course, been talking about the impact of the presidential election. We had Congressman Andy Harris. He's now the lone Republican in the Maryland delegation. We'll keep in touch with him, see what's going on. Also in our studio, Michael Laughlin. He's a political science professor at Salisbury University. Also looking at same-sex marriage and the passage of that measure, Diane Wagner. She's with Salisbury University, as well as Wes Davis, a former United Methodist pastor, also with Salisbury University. You've been listening to Delmarva Today. I'm Don Rush, and thanks for listening.
This has been Delmarva Today, a production of Delmarva Public Radio. Chris Rank produces and is our audio engineer. Our volunteer producers are Penny Hartman, Kathleen Grout, and Jim White. Don Rush is your host. For podcasts, visit our website, delmarvapublicradio.net, or subscribe to the Delmarva Today podcast in iTunes. Delmarva Today can now be seen on PAC-14. To view the schedule, visit the Daily Times or visit PAC14.org.